Welcome to SelfDiscoveryWisdom.com, formerly known as Self Discovery Media. On these podcasts, you're going to hear people who speak from the heart. They've taken the journey in life. Many things have happened to them, but they've changed it to happening for them. And in their strength, their courage, they've discovered their abilities and their wisdom, and they are now sharing it here with you. Do enjoy each show. We bring it to you with love and knowing that it's going to help you on your journey of life. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Their Story Matters, right here on SelfDiscoveryWisdom.com. I'm your host, Sarah Troy. My wonderful guest is Ona Gritz. We're going to be talking about something that happened to her that is also very sad. Everywhere I Look is a book that she has written about her sister that was killed, tragically killed, and she wanted to unravel the mystery behind the murder of her sister, Andre Susan Gritz, also known as Angie Boggs. So while sharing her own awakening of loss, grief, and guilt, and truth, her story is a testament to the idea that grief can be transformative and that the truth can truly set us free. The book is coming out April 16th, but you can pre-order it. We'll talk more about the book as we go. She says, on January 11th, 1982, Angie Boggs was brutally murdered in her home, alongside with her husband, Ray, and their 11-month-old son. Oh, wow. She was 25 and pregnant with their second child. 6 weeks later, Angie's body was found, stuffed in a crawl space of an apartment that she had shared with her family and her murderers. When Angie was just a little girl, Andrea, she was the first person Ona remembered loving. Gritz was 19 when she learned of her sister's murder. Well, she's dead, their mum announced, and with a crisscross slap of the hands, later remarking, a social worker told us a year ago that the way Andrea lived her life, she wouldn't make it to 30, and that made Gritz angry. She wasn't grief-stricken either. After all, she was used to being without Angie for many years after losing her. All she felt was numb. And when Ona, in her late 40s, the only survivor of her immediate family, in the succession to a small events began to bring Angie back to her, suddenly she was filled with questions about the despairing view of Angie. And despite her love and her initial lies from her parents, she's a runaway. Grow up, that's what her Ona answer always seemed to hear. Where is your sister? What was Angie running from? Why did our parents keep shutting her out and sending her away? Well, today we're going to unravel some of that mystery, but also deal with the grief and the loss. To lose somebody in any way, to lose somebody that also lose a child, are pregnant with a child, the husband, the whole family gone, and not really having any answers behind it. Having an attitude of, well, guess she got what she deserved, isn't something that's going to help anybody heal from loss. So the questions she dove into, and she wrote the book, and this is what we're going to be talking about today. It's wonderful that you're honoring your sister in this way. And yes, it does take some time, doesn't it, for one to go through one's life, to understand one's own life, to then be able to look back, because you can't do it at the time. You're in grief, you're in loss, you're in dismay, you're in despair. How can you look at anything rationally in that way? So doing this some years later and being able to look back, in many ways, you see things so much more clearer, don't you? Welcome to the show, Ona.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for having me. Yeah, and I would add that there was denial in that mix of grief and dismay, and a kind of stuckness, for lack of a better word. Yeah. My sister began leaving home for good reason when she was very young and I was younger, so I tended to view her with the same eyes. I've got this puppy that wants to.
Oh,
join
puppies could join us.
Oh,
gosh, yes. Hello, puppy. I love it. No, they love it. They like the vibrations. So, yes.
Yeah. So I, for the longest time, until I was that woman in my late 40s, when I thought about Angie, I thought about her from the perspective of a little girl. There were a lot of things I didn't understand, and there were a lot of things I didn't know. And I didn't understand that I could find those things out, even though I was, a perfectly functioning adult at that point. I was working as a librarian. Research wasn't new to me, but it didn't occur to me that I could find out more about my sister's life. And I think in part that was self-protective.
Yes.
There were things that were difficult to know. So a way to protect myself was to not even be curious, to kind of put all of it on the shelf and focus on other things.
I love the support your puppy is giving you right now, knowing that this is a tough topic, right? I'm there for you, which is what puppy dogs are all about.
Definitely.
I mean, it's a trauma. You went through a trauma. It
I
wasn't
did.
just the loss of your sister, it's the loss of the whole family, your nieces or nephews, whoever would be there. And it's the way that it was done, right?
Yes.
And all it leaves is question mark, question mark, question marks. Why? And then to have that attitude, from your mom, it's like, well, why did she kind of, because it was almost implying that she deserved it because of the path that she was taking. And it's like, who can say that about a child?
Yeah.
Right, or
Yeah.
if you are going to say it with despair rather
Yeah.
than, well, she got what she wanted. And it's like that had to be a real slap in the face as well. So that's kind of adding on to the trauma.
And I would say even more so because I was very close to my mother and she was very loving and very present for me, which made it a complicated family to grow up in, to be the favored, to be so blatantly favored,
Yes.
to love my sister, but also to be getting this message as I'm growing up that she is somehow less worthy than I am, that the difficult life she had, she brought on herself. And part of me didn't believe that, and part of me did.
Well, you kind of look at it, well, how can mom love me so much and not love her in the same way? What did she do that her mum deemed her unlovable? But you had a lovable relationship with your sister. So it's just such a huge gap, isn't it? And it's what went on? And as you said, what was she running from? So was it just a conflict between them of personalities, or was there something more there?
It's pretty complicated. Angie was adopted into our family.
Ah, that makes a big difference, yes.
Yeah, so there are some mysteries that I solve in the book, and I don't want to give them all away.
Right.
But one thing that I will say, because I reveal this pretty early on, is that my parents were secretive people, and my mother had been married before, and she had two children. And my father was not interested in being a stepfather, so they were sent to their father. They didn't tell us that we had these siblings. We knew them as distant cousins. And so, when I found out some of the things that I found out about, choices my parents made that affected Angie, places that they sent her within the foster care system and the juvenile justice system, really terrible places. And I didn't know any of this. I thought they were boarding schools. That's how they were
Yes.
described to me. But I was very angry to find these things out. I was heartbroken on Angie's behalf. But I tried as hard as I could to also continue to have some compassion for my parents. And, my mother was not allowed to raise her own children.
Yeah, that for a lot of listeners would be a hard one, because I know if I was given that ultimatum for a man, there's the door.
Exactly,
There's the door,
exactly.
right? It's not, me or without my children. You to love me is to love my children, because that is an extension of me.
Right.
You can understand sometimes. I've heard so many stories through today's my 12th anniversary of podcasting. So through the years, I've definitely heard some stories, and where some women have left because they were powerless to do anything while in the marriage, and they left to see if they could do something externally to get their child. But It's I can't ever understand a mother leaving to go to another man and you not have anything to do with your children. So was your mom not necessarily maternal?
She became more maternal when I was born, I'll
Hmm.
say that. And I'll say that the time in our culture was different then. So she had the difficult experience of having a divorce in 1950,
Hmm.
and in 1950 that was so frowned upon. As my father, I remember my father once saying, "Nobody but movie stars get divorces." It was unheard of at the time.
Yes.
But she was in a marriage where her husband was openly having affairs, and it was very devastating, both to be in that marriage and also to choose to leave it. And I think she felt a lot of pressure in the early 1950s not to be a single mother,
Yeah.
not to be alone. And I think my father didn't show that side of him quite. She was already separated from her son because he chose, if you can say, you give a 7-year-old a choice, but
Right.
he went with his father, who moved 3,000 miles away. They were on the West Coast. We were in New York. So she was in a hard place, and she made a choice that I would like to think in that situation I would never make.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I remember it was the 60s. My dad had been given quite a quote, a death sentence. He had had a heart attack, and they told him, you've got 4 months to live. Instead of
Oh,
saying,
goodness.
change your lifestyle, right? If we do this, we do that, you'll be okay. But instead he gave him that. And he was a fighter pilot in the war, and he had post-traumatic stress from that, right? And so for him, he was back in the Spitfire. And drank too much, drove too much, and just made life hell for everybody. And when my mom said, I can't take this mom, I'm going to take the kids and go. And he says, no, you can go. I'll change the lock on the doors and you'll never see your kids again.
Oh,
And so
goodness.
for mom, she was trapped. He did die. He died at 45. I understand more of his troubles now, but it's lack of support for anybody for anything at that time. We've got to remember people in the 50s having children came out of the wartime. And what happened during the war definitely had an effect on them. Where was the emotional support? Post-traumatic stress was not even a thing. And if you showed a sign of weakness of anything, you weren't a man. And
That's right.
so there was just no support anywhere along the line for men or women. And we let them down. And so consequently, it trickled down into the
Yes.
family dynamics.
Yes, very much so. And my father was in World War II and came back with what we called in those days a nervous disorder. And also, the two of them were raised in the Depression. And my father's reaction to that was to always feel that other people were trying to take advantage of him.
It's generation after generation, isn't it? Is that we carry the scars.
Yes.
And instead of being able to see and be in the present of what life has to offer me now, what opportunities I have now, we carry the burden and the scars from in our DNA, from our
Yes.
ancestors.
It's
Very
true.
often they weigh us down and we don't understand why am I feeling so heavy and moving forward. And it's only when we stop to look back at the ancestral pattern that we realize, ah, now I kind of relate. I relate why I do this or how I feel this way. And it's okay then to release it, but it's very often we just don't understand what we're carrying isn't ours.
It's true. And my parents left Eastern Europe in pogroms. So, I've got all of that fear and trauma in my DNA, as you say. And then, speaking about how people were treated at different points in our history, when my sister and I were growing up, I was born in the early 60s. She was born in the mid 50s. In late 1968, 1970, when your child misbehaved, you said, it was perfectly acceptable to send them away. if your child ran away from home, if they acted out at home, if they skipped school, that was grounds to call the police on them and have them arrested. There was a law in the books that allowed that to be punishable by imprisonment.
Instead of
And
asking why are they running away, what's going on at home that you want to run away from? So obviously your
exactly.
sister kept running away because happens a great deal when people adopt a child and then have a child. You know, the adopted child is all the attention because maybe they thought they couldn't have one. And then comes the birth, you know, the natural birth child, and then all the attention is on that child. Well, can we just get rid of this one now?
That's kind of what the feeling was like in our home, that she was expendable and I was the replacement. And of course, I carried a lot of guilt about that.
Right, which of course, no guilt to be had, no shame, no blame, because you were just a child. You didn't ask for any of this, right? Also, you didn't comprehend what was going on with your sister. You know, and maybe she wasn't willing to confide in you at that time, or maybe, you know, it just you didn't see it because you saw your mum from one angle, you didn't see it from her angle.
I witnessed a lot, and I recognized the imbalance. I knew that I had more power in the family. I knew that, if I were to tell my mother something, she'd believe me. And as a little girl, there were times I wielded that. But I remember visiting a friend when I was very little and saying to her, she had brothers, and I said, "Well, you're your mother's favorite, right?" And she said, "Oh, my mother doesn't have favorites. She has enough love in her heart for all of us." And I just found that baffling. And I said, "But you're the only girl, so you secretly know you're the favorite, right?" She was adamant, "No, my mother doesn't have favorites." And I just thought, "Oh, well, I guess her mother says that just to be nice."
All right. Because, you know, what we're brought up with is what we learn, you know, to understand. So, of course, that's going to be how it feels. Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? You know, I brought up in England, so we were all sent off to boarding school very early. You know, my brother and sister were sent off to school around 6 and 7. I was sent off just before my 9th birthday. I was a little later because I was a sickly child. And, you know, boarding school, even though it was an hour away, instead of going home at the weekends, it would just be half term and end of term. And sometimes I'd be the only child there at the weekend. And it's just a norm, kind of, you know, that off the kids, and then you see, and I having got 3 kids, yeah, there's sometimes I'd like to send them away. But you know, my ex-husband used to always say, we're going to send them to China to boarding school because he was Chinese, right? And he was real about it, and I said, absolutely no way, my kids ain't going nowhere. But yeah, it is interesting because when you look at the times, and yes, I'm going to do my shameless plug now of our Forgotten Children book, 15 chapters on what we need to change around our system and raising children and supporting families. And if we put as much understanding and effort and money behind supporting families and in the raising of our children, educating of our children, we would have a much stronger and stable society. So this is a fundraiser book where all money proceeds goes to each author's organization that supports families and children. And that's the reason for this book, which is book one in the series, is we're unaware are some of the systems and the programs that are still running that are so detrimental to a family. And it's like, well, it's always been like this. Does that mean it should always be like this? Should we not look at the repercussions of it being like this and work it out that it's not working?
And the places that my sister was sent, they were state run, but the state got money, and it created jobs in the communities. There were all kinds of reasons to keep these places open that had nothing to do with whether they were any good for the children that were there.
Where was the counseling for the children? Where was the trying to understand why they ran away or why they were feeling like this? Mean the amount of children that went through sex abuse, and it was always like, no, you're lying. unless it was completely obvious. And it's a it is quite horrendous, some of the stories I've heard of grandfathers, fathers, uncles, and mothers knowing about it. And it's just horrific. And but where did the child have to go to tell anyone that they would be believed?
And then they go from one unsafe environment to another.
Exactly. Here's a statistic for you, which is actually in the book with one of our authors who is a foster mum. And over 25 years, she's fostered 17 children, all boys, because she wanted to give boys a chance. That 70% of men incarcerated are foster children. Now, that screams to me how we've let those children down. 70% of foster children are the ones that end up in jail, right? And that totally tells me that the nurturing and the support was not there. And boy, oh boy, do we need a lot of work to change that system. And it really does sound like your sister was the disposable one, ran away because she felt like that, and then running to places where they just looked at her as garbage anyway.
And where when she wasn't in those places, she was on the street and she had to figure things out as a really young girl. And of course, her body was the one thing she had that she could offer.
Right. It's what happens on the street. And for her to feel that home was worse than the street, right? To feel even more unsafe at home than being in the street, having to sell her body to survive. But she married. She had one child, she was pregnant with another. She looked like she had settled down. So why wasn't there some embracement of that?
I my father embraced it. My mother was it's hard to understand, but my mother begrudged her even that little bit of happiness. And
It speaks a lot, obviously, to the way your mother was brought up, that maybe the love that you got is the love she wanted as a child. And the love that she didn't get, she passed on to your sister. Did your mum grow up in an unloving environment?
I never had that sense during my mother's lifetime. But one of the things that I did in researching this book was to find long lost relatives. And I wound up briefly, she was elderly, so I lost this aunt. But for a brief time, I had a lovely rapport with my mother's brother's wife. And she and her brother were estranged. And so I didn't get to know this aunt growing up, but she was willing to tell me a lot about the family and answer some big questions that I had. But one of the things that she told me was that they were left to their own devices growing up. Their own mother had been a very angry person. And they both parents worked constantly, so the kids would come home and they'd have there'd be change left for them to go take themselves to the movies, but nobody was checking to make sure that they went to school. Nobody was really there for
Raising
them.
them, raising them.
She told me, her husband, my mother's brother, went to summer camp where a sleepaway camp where Sundays were visiting day, and he was the only child whose parents didn't come on Sundays to be with him. So that was my mother's parents, though she never said anything negative about them to me. So I never knew that in her lifetime. But that's why when I spoke to this aunt, she said, I grew to understand your mother and her choices once I really got to know this family.
That's the problem, isn't it? We're always a byproduct of the history of the family, right? And we're a byproduct of somebody else's pain. And this is why in our lifetimes, we have got to change that DNA message, change that cycle, so that our children aren't going through the trauma that we went through. and that their children aren't going to go through the trauma, and that, today we can talk about this. This isn't a sign of weakness anymore. It's a sign of strength, of facing those demons that chase us, facing the obstacles that are in our way, beginning to understand it. If we don't talk about it, if we don't address it, if we don't try and heal it, something that could have been extremely small has gathered bigger and bigger and bigger momentum. And now you don't even know the reason why. It's like when you have families pitted against families for generations, and it was an argument over a fence some 100 years ago. And it's like the feud is still going on because nobody broke the chain. Nobody broke the cycle. Nobody stopped to say, no, that is the past. I'm not feeding that. I'm changing the script on our DNA here. We can do that today because there's so much aid. But back in the day, because I was born in 54, so back in the day, there was none of that. It was a sign of weakness. My own grandfather was, he was a colonel in the Indian Army, British colonel in the Indian Army. And my mother was told he had died. And instead, what had happened is they had sent him to a mental institution because he had a breakdown. And what he had was post-traumatic stress, but in those days, they called it something different. Right. And he lived there, I think, for the rest of his life. And she met him as an uncle, only to find out later she had spoken with her father, and she really wanted a relationship with her father. They both had a wonderful way with words. And, and you know, the mother and the higher sisters decided this was best.
Right. Secrecy was okay in those days, and it was doing so much damage.
Yes, so you don't air your dirty linen in public, right? Just, And a lot of that was that societal ignorance and putting shame and blame on things where it didn't belong.
Right. So people felt that they had to put up a prettier front. And the only way to do that was to keep secrets.
Yes, the facade. Yes.
Yeah.
I know when I was writing my book, you know, my mother and my sister were both worried about that. What am I going to reveal? What am I going to say? You're not going to share this or share that. And it's you know, the fear of it. And for me, I was completely opposite in, I don't want to lie. I don't want to be ashamed of things that have happened to me or even choices that I've done. I'll own them if they're stupid, right? But this lying thing, or this feeling ashamed of something, is so counterproductive. I just don't want the burden of it.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think, you know, being secretive, it just feeds that feeling of shame.
And then a feeling of less.
Yes.
Right. The lower value, feeling that you're going to be ostracized, punished, persecuted. Right. Because let's face it, we've been brought up with seeing people with the pitchforks on the ready to persecute you for what you've done. And that is the society that especially our age group most certainly grew up with, that now is taking place more in cyberland, right? So that viciousness is coming out there, but it is more accountable, even though it's cowardly because it's done behind a computer or a phone. It's more cowardly, but it is more accountable. Where other people, if they don't join the bandwagon, can stand up for the person. But when it's going on behind closed doors and it's all secretive, who does one speak to?
Right.
How were they murdered? I mean, why were they murdered? Was that resolved?
So they were murdered by a couple who they had brought in to help pay the rent. They considered this couple friends of theirs. Coincidentally, if there is such a thing as coincidence, I was visiting San Francisco the week it happened. The night before it happened, I was in the apartment. I was spending time with the two people who did it. My sister and brother-in-law actually left the house for a while to run an errand. We all sat around watching an old Errol Flynn movie on TV. And I was staying with a friend who had a hotel room in San Francisco. So I left that night when my sister and brother-in-law got back. And then I couldn't reach them after that. And I didn't worry the way I might have worried because she was always disappearing. So it just felt like, oh, well, that's what she does, you know.
So she was still disappearing, although she was happily married.
Well, see, that's where I was wrong, you know, because before she, not long before she was married, she would fall in and out of touch, in and out of touch. And things would happen like, you know, there was one time a few years before that when I was still in high school when we made plans to visit, and whatever phone number we had for her was out of service all of a sudden, and we couldn't get in touch with her. So we didn't get to see her on that visit. So when she disappeared with her husband, I just thought, you know, they skipped out on the rent or something. Where, you know, it got more worrisome as the week went on that nobody was answering the phone. But I was used to her disappearing and reappearing. And then, so I came back home after that week that I was there. And a few weeks after that, we found out that my brother-in-law had been killed. And we still didn't know what had happened to her and the baby. But the couple had taken what they had done is they, I don't know the order, whether they killed the baby first and then my sister. So I don't know if if her last experience was seeing her baby die. I just don't know. But she was strangled and the baby was most likely suffocated. My brother-in-law did come home from work. In fact, I spoke to him. I did get through to him a couple of times that night, and he was wondering where she was. And I was kind of like, well, do I tell him that this is like she does this? You know, I didn't know what to say. They shot him that night with his own rifle. And the reason that they were found as quickly as they were, which was within months, is they took everything. They took his van. That's what they were traveling in. They took the gun they shot him with. They took my sister's diamond ring that she would never take off. They took his parrot. And everywhere they went, they sold these things. So they left this breadcrumb trail
Right.
to follow.
But why did they kill them? But why? I mean, you can rob them without killing them.
Right. I don't know. I don't know. I've spoken to the prosecutor who I got to know in the process of researching the book, and he remembered that one of the theories was that the baby had woken the man up, and he went into a rage, which maybe is true. I read, according to the transcripts that I read in the trial transcripts, there was a kid who lived in their building, a little boy who had a tricycle, and he Philip Henderson, the murderer, went into a rage screaming at this little kid because of where he left his tricycle in the hallway. So I don't know, you know, if then Angie tried to defend the baby or what happened there
But she
that
wasn't killed in the apartment, though.
she was.
Oh, and then they moved the body.
They moved the body. There's a crawl space underneath the house.
But why did
They
they move her and the baby and not him?
moved him too, which I didn't know. I had a little misunderstanding. I thought he had been found in the apartment. But in fact, when I went back and read everything and followed it along, you know, just article by article on microfilm, his body was also under the house, but it was further towards the front. They were all wrapped in bedding. So they found his body. Her body and the baby's body was further back into in the crawl space and hidden behind a headboard and some other, you know, debris. And so they found her, I think 3 weeks later in the same place.
Are those people still in jail?
He died in prison
Karma.
yes, I think it was 2017, I want to say. And that was a very scary moment because I had just signed up to for victim services to be informed of any changes, and the notice that came said notice of release. I could read that through the envelope, and I
You
was in
didn't
the
even want to
car.
open it, huh?
I didn't want to open it. I got in the car. My son had driven me to the post office. I got into my son's car, and they released him. I was just beside myself, and he said, "Open the envelope." And it said released due to death.
Right.
So
Did
he
she go to
died.
jail? His wife?
She did. And she served, I think, 38 years. And they were both given multiple life sentences without the possibility of parole. And I, even though I, at this point, was signed up for victim services, they didn't bother to try to find me when they made this decision. Just about a year ago to let her go. They didn't try to find me. They didn't try to find my brother-in-law's brothers. They notified me after the fact the decision had already been made. So she's currently released. She's very sick, apparently, very immobile. But we had no say in that. It just was hard. It kind of reopened the wounds.
Of course, of course. And I mean, what possesses people to do something like that? You know, when a person has that much rage, what happened to him in his childlike? Or is it the wiring in the brain which can cause it? But to be so outraged to kill a whole family. And like, if they shot your brother-in-law, how come nobody heard the gun, the gunshot?
That's a really good question.
There must have been a scream somewhere along the line. You know, is it is have we got so unneighborly that we just take everything, oh, just another gunshot, we don't pay any attention? I especially in an apartment.
Yeah, I don't know. They were in San Francisco in the city proper, so I don't know, how noisy it was on their street. That's actually something I hadn't thought about. But
It
you're right.
was, you know, we hear these things like there was a scenario here happened in Canada just a little while ago. An immigrant family took in somebody into their home to help pay for the rent, and that person ended up killing the entire family. And it's like, you know, makes people very, very nervous about who they're getting in, obviously, because you don't know. You do need to do background checks and things like that. But yes, it can be quite scary. Because you don't know. And really, if you're taking anything from this, folks, if you're looking at renting out a room or renting a space, you are absolutely entitled to get a background check on that person, where they've lived before, their work, everything. That's not to say people can't switch in a moment's notice, but at least if they have a tendency towards it, there is a trail there. And it's we've got to this point in time when we feel, oh no, that's too intrusive, you know, to do that. And no, it's your home. You're entitled to feel safe in your home, and you want to know that you do feel safe with this person you've let in your home. Oh, so many lessons here to learn. I mean, your grieving process, not just losing your sister, but the two babies, you know, everything. Knowing that you were actually in the city when this happened, right? I mean, all of that had to have an impact on you. There's the loss and the grief in the moment. Then there's the delayed loss and grief that hits you later.
Yes.
What was that like for you?
Well, for me, I spent a certain amount of time kind of trying to access my grief, trying to find it again because I felt like I was so there was something wrong with me that I didn't feel more, and of course that is one of the ways that grief works, right?
Yes.
It can be numbing,
Be
but I
matter of
didn't
fact
understand.
about it, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
and I
Yeah.
didn't understand that. And then at some point, I just put it away, and it wasn't really a part of my conscious life. I even think about when my own son was born. Why didn't I think about my sister and that little baby boy?
Because you were
But
in joy and you didn't want to let the pain in.
yes, yeah.
Right, quite a natural
And
response there.
my parents and my half siblings were all had all died at the point where I finally cracked all this open. And I think that there was a reason for that, that I wasn't ready to face the things that I would have to face about my parents. I couldn't jeopardize the relationship. My brother was the last to die, and he and I, he was the secret. I didn't know who he was, until I was a teenager, and we wound up very close in adulthood. But when he finally died, all of a sudden, I started thinking about Angie, and I started wondering about her, and I started missing her, and I started feeling all that grief, which in some ways I was grateful to feel because it was long overdue. It was inside me. It was masked as shame instead of sorrow. And it also it allowed me to miss her, which allowed me to think about her again and feel her presence again, because that's part of what missing does. And then once I started investigating, and once I committed myself to wanting to not just know this story, but write it and share it, it was like she and I were a team. We were together constantly. She was who I thought about. She was who I talked to. It took me a while to find this, but I eventually wrote the book so that I was speaking to her on the page. So it's written in second person as almost like a letter to her. And it
And the
just,
title "Everywhere I Look," is this because everywhere you look, something else was revealed?
yes. And everywhere I look, I found her. I'd get on a bus and I would see someone who reminded me of her in some way, and I would just sit and stare at that person and take in that essence. And there's a line in the Rolling Stones song, Angie, Angie, I still love you, baby. Everywhere I look, I see your eyes. And so it also comes from that, because her birth name was Andrea. Her name at home growing up was Andra. But ultimately, around the time that song came out, and I think because of that song, she chose the name Angie, and that was her name for the last years of her life.
It is so senseless. Violence is so senseless. It's so sad that we haven't evolved as human beings beyond this need to kill. For some people, it's a compulsion. For some people, it's greed. We see a great deal of it in wars. It's all profit and power. We are so much more than that. We are so much more, and we're meant to be at a higher level, in our consciousness and humanity, and yet we are still at this level of I want what I want and I'll take what I want and I don't care who pays for it. And I think that this is when you look at it, where a whole family can be wiped out, and I mean, thank God they were stupid. So they were actually caught, because there are many people that the killers are all still out there and they never have that closure. So thank God for that. And I know that baby killers in jail do not necessarily receive any favoritism, because that's always a line that most criminals will not crush across. You don't touch babies. So hopefully he got his just due there. Did you?
I don't know a lot, but he actually somehow had the privilege of writing a few articles that wound up online, in which he told his made-up version of the story, where, someone else did it and they were framed. And in those blog pieces, he doesn't even acknowledge that the baby existed. He doesn't acknowledge that Angie was pregnant. So I don't know what his cellmates and prison mates knew about exactly what he had done. But I also know he was racist. He was a member of a white supremacy group.
Right, which is
And
based in anger.
yeah, so I think he had some, the prosecutor alluded to some issues that he got beaten up because of that behavior, because of how he acted out based on those.
People don't get to know what you're in for, you know, even if a, you know, somebody let slip, and these articles I would assume kind of came later. But you know, it's always sad when people can't own up to what they've done. But again, at that point, you forgive them, but you don't forget. But the forgiveness is for you, right? To release you and not forgiving them and their actions, because otherwise you still remain a prisoner of the pain that they've caused.
I would have thought so, but I will say that in my long period of numbness and ignorance, I didn't blame them, not because I didn't trust that they did it. I knew they did it, but it was like they weren't real to me. They were like, it was just not that they were inanimate objects, but they were part of this story that I couldn't quite take in
Behind the
as
veil, so to
actual.
speak.
Yes. So when I read his articles, they infuriated me so much because of the things that he left out, because of the ways that he lied, because of his swarmy way of describing my sister and brother-in-law, and everything about it was so awful that I was furious for the first time. And it was actually a healthy anger that kind of broke me open. So I wouldn't say that I've ever forgiven them, but it's not like I walk around feeling that I'm not hurting myself with that, with that unforgiveness, the way that lack of forgiveness can hurt the person who's carrying it around. I think my job was more to forgive my parents.
Because they let her down right from the word go.
Yeah.
And you know, we never know what our life is going to be, or what's going to happen, or what we witness, or what we're subjected to. You know, we don't always have a choice of what happens to us. We do have a choice with what we do with it.
Yeah.
They didn't have a choice. Their choices were snuffed out. But I'm glad that so many years later that he wrote that article of lies to break you open, for you to get angry, to share this story. You know, some people will think, oh, this is far-fetched and never does happen. It's literally just happened here in the last couple of months. And it was an immigrant family. So, you know, they'd left one country of terror to come to peace, and you know, ended up being somebody that they took in. And it's always awful when we have something like that, because your sister and son and brother-in-law were in trust.
They were in trust, and that was my sister. She was always the kid who brought home the stray cats, and who always had a lot of empathy for the underdog and the outsider.
And you know, it's all very well, you know, people saying, well, they should have known. You sat with them, you watched TV with them. Where were the indications? It's until the trigger is there. I mean, obviously you're white. Had you been of any different color, they wouldn't have been there in the first place, right? But obviously there wasn't evidence of white supremacy. But you know, it's we yes, but when did this happen? What year?
1982.
So in 1982, we didn't have the internet,
No.
right? We didn't have cell phones. We had pagers, right?
Right.
There wasn't the same information that was so easily accessible.
That's right.
So, you know, and also the information was always based on somebody interpreting what they saw. Well, was that the right interpretation? And so now, with everything being online, the other problem we have now is, can we believe what we see online?
True.
Right? So we have the other scale of the things, but it's so much easier to actually do the research because there are platforms in which one can go to. But you still need to talk to the people who were behind it. And I've known a few police people in my time, and they've said the worst is when they go to a scene when it involves children. And that is something that they always carry with them, you know, forever. And it just is, why do people become so utterly violent and feel they have the right to
Yeah.
do this? And but it's almost like your poor sister's path was paved for her as a child, of, you know, one thing after the other for her, that she wasn't deemed to have happiness. Well, she had it for a short while, right?
We had it for a short while, which is both lovely and heartbreaking because
Yes.
for the first time, she had a lot to lose.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my goodness. A really tough story. I can understand why you veiled yourself from the pain and everything else for as long as you did. How can you carry on? You know, when you feel hopeless and helpless to have done anything about it, you have no power to do anything about it. They did get caught. They did go to jail. But it's, as you said, you were busy in your life, navigating your life. To carry that burden of sorrow with you at that time through that navigation could have pulled you right down. So in our psyche is quite incredible, the way it compartmentalizes things. I'm putting this on the shelf,
Right.
right? You can take it off the shelf later when you're stronger.
Yeah.
But right now I'm putting the sorrow on the shelf. And
Yeah.
it's weird. Like when my dad died, I went to my mother and said, God took the one that was the weakest and left the one that was the strongest. And one of these people, when somebody loses somebody, they call me because I'm very matter of fact about death. Because it will happen to all of us. Now, if it happens in a violent way, that's a totally different feeling altogether. But I don't grieve in the same way because I know they're fine. They've all moved on to, they've gone home, so to speak. It's what they've left behind that we miss, how we miss them, or how they were taken out. And that's it's funny because that picture of that dog on the wall over there is, I mourn her, and it's 7 years in August since she's gone. I mourn her than I mourned my dad. Mind you, I was 11 when my dad died, right? But is and I think it is that we move it into different areas, or, you know, into different things, because that way we can cope with it or rationalize it. And it is a matter of fact that we all do die, and some people die way too soon and ways that they shouldn't be. But it's your mind and everything just wants to rationalize, because that is our mechanism of getting through. But having the courage and the strength now to do the research, to open up this Pandora box, to go through everything and see it again, but through different eyes, obviously through stronger eyes, you know, through the loving eyes, but also through the empowered eyes of, I really want her story told now, and I can honor who she is, who she was. And you can do it in a way now with your life skills. You are a poet, so obviously through this book there, you know, there's going to be some lovely rhythm and rhyme to your writing.
Thank
And
you.
you wouldn't have been able to tell that story back then. But from where you are now and the research that you could do, and without feeling the shame and the blame, but just reconnecting with her, bringing her back to life, right,
Yes.
of her story, is honoring you.
It felt like the one thing that I could do for her when
Yeah.
there was so much I couldn't have done in her lifetime.
Right. Yeah.
That
Yeah.
this was it. This was
Yes.
why Angie's little sister was a writer, so that she had her story could be told, and she didn't die for nothing.
Exactly. And what a beautiful, you know, honoring. And for anybody that reads it, obviously they're going to read all the horrific things that happened to her. But the epiphany of the story is that however rocky her road was in growing up, and whatever she was running away from, which was most certainly a feeling of you're unwanted, you're not enough, right?
Absolutely.
And looking to be enough elsewhere. For whatever her rocky journey was, she found love. She found love in having a child. She was carrying another child. She'd reached that epiphany of happiness in her life. And she had that. And so when she crossed over whatever the trauma was in the moment, the joy and happiness that she did have is her crossing over with her. And that makes it just a little bit lighter and a little bit happier that you see so many stories of people that their life is just heading for that crash, heading for that doomsday, and they never have a moment of happiness. And she found that, and that was a beautiful gift.
She did. And when I found her grave, which was only after I did all this research, what I discovered was that they were cremated and then put together.
Ah,
And there was something about that
yes.
that really touched me, that they were merged, that
Yes.
they somehow their death seemed less lonely when I thought of it in that way.
Yes, it means that, it doesn't matter. Well, it does matter, obviously, but in the way that it doesn't matter that their life was taken from them, they still found a way of coming back together, that they couldn't be torn apart.
Right.
Right?
They
So that,
literally became one.
yes, yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you for writing such a beautiful story. I know it couldn't have been easy. How many years did it take you?
Oh, just a decade.
Yes, because I imagine that it was pick it up, do some work, and then put it down too heavy,
Yeah.
right? And
For
come back. Yeah,
long
yeah.
stretches, I had to put it down. And I also had to learn how to tell the
Yeah.
story in a way that would make sense and resonate for other people.
Did you feel her like over your shoulder or in your hands, in your words? Did you let her channel through you to say some of the things?
It really felt like a collaboration.
Lovely.
Even to the extent where, when I needed information, there was a point in which something I didn't know popped into my head, and I'm sure that she
Yeah.
whispered it in my ear.
Yes. Yes. So it was a teamwork, right? So it's
Yeah.
like, I've got you, sis. Let's do this together.
Exactly, which is what made writing such a painful book not always painful, but
Yeah.
actually healing.
What do you want people to get out of this book?
That's a really good question, Sarah. Thank you. I part of what I want people to understand is that, and it's in many ways the same message that you're choosing to put forth, is this is what happens to our throwaway children.
Yes. Yes. So preventable. Right? And the fact that they took these people in and trust you sat with them, you knew them to a point. They didn't show those outwardly signs, right? But imagine if she had grown up with loving support. She was clearly a woman who loved to love, who had a lot of love to give.
She sure did. And she left home before she could finish school. So, had she not had to do that, she would have had a lot more doors
Yeah.
open to her.
Yeah. Yes. We don't want any more children to be forgotten. We
No.
don't, and we want people to stand up for children, whether you are a person that is a foster child in a family, or you were adopted, or your sibling and you've got an adopted child there. It's please equal playing field. There is enough love within us to pour out on not just one, but on a dozen children,
Yeah.
right? We've
Yeah.
got enough love. And look at love as a musical instrument. Each one of those children are going to be a chord, right?
Oh,
And when
that's
you have them
beautiful.
together, they become a symphony.
That's beautiful. And had my father had an open heart towards my mother's children,
Yes,
I think
exactly.
my mother's heart would have been different toward my sister.
You obviously got to know your half siblings.
I did, my brother especially. My sister, half sister, died. I was an adult, but we lived far apart. We never really connected. But where we have connected is that she has wonderful children, my nieces and nephews, and they've really become mine. We've become each other's.
That's
That's
wonderful.
been such a gift.
It sounds like your brothers and sisters all died very early, very young.
Well, they were quite a bit older than I. My brother was 20 years older. My sister
Oh.
was 16 years older. So yeah, relatively young, but adults. My sister had hepatitis C, and my brother battled cancer for many years.
Yes. Well, I think also in writing this book, you've released that DNA pattern. So this is now, pattern changing in your son. So
I
that
hope
isn't
so.
not going to be repeated, because this is how we break the ch cycle. This is how we break that chain of repetitive pain that we don't realize is, passed on from one family member to another. And that by breaking that chain, and hopefully then that becomes something. I remember mother saying to me, "You've brought your children up the way you wanted to be brought up." Right? And it's like breaking that chain. Doesn't mean I didn't do things perfectly, because I wanted to do things differently. So it was just as much as an experiment. But at the same time, it's all about us asking for help. I think that's one of the things that we don't do as parents. We've got this belief that we're meant to do it all, which is codswallop. It's always taken a village to raise a child. And it takes an extended family. It takes chosen family. It takes neighborhood to look out for the kids. And we need to step up and start being there and recognizing when there's something going wrong in a family. And it's not intervention where we're coming to take the kids away and drawing the police on it, but even stepping up to the family and just saying, "I feel there's something wrong. Can we help?" And if even if you get shut down, right, you can then assess a little bit more. But don't play ignorant. Don't go, "Well, la 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 la, it's nothing of my business." If a child keeps running away, they're running away from something. They don't run to prostitution for fun of it. They're running away from something that's more painful. So let us be there for our children and not label them, "Ugh, losers, runaways." No. They're beautiful human souls that have not been nurtured right, and we need to pick up that nurture
That's
and
right.
be
They're
there.
in our care.
They're in
They're
our
all
care.
in each other's care.
Yes. And when we start caring, right, we start re resolving. And that's something that we need to do. We need to get out of our own ego or self-importance, or it's nothing to do with me, and realize whatever happens to your neighbor's child can happen to your child. We need to be there for each other. So, but I am so happy that she did find that happiness for however long she had it, and that
I
they
am too.
are together, because robbed of their physical life, but not robbed of their spiritual life. They will carry on in a different dimension, which hopefully is a lot friendlier than this one.
Thank you.
So the book comes out April 16th for people who are listening to this, and it is on Amazon and it's on bookstore. And all they have to
Bookshop.
do, a bookshop, right? And all they have to do is put "Everywhere I Look" and put a memoir, put in your name, Ona Gritz, which is ONA Gritz, GRITZ. And you can get the book there. There's a lovely picture of the two sisters on the cover there, which that must have been hard choosing the picture.
The
But
publisher made the choice,
oh,
so
really? And
they
yeah,
made it easy for me.
yes. You must have gone, "No, is it this one? Is it this one? Is it this one?"
Exactly.
And of course, people can get hold of you at onagritz.com,
Yes.
ONAGRITZ.com, and you're on Instagram and Ona Gritz as well. And people can reach out to you, love to have a conversation or discuss your poetry or anything.
I would love to meet with book groups if anyone
Yes.
is interested in reading Everywhere I Look as a group. I would love to be part of that conversation as well.
Now, here's a thought, folks. I'm always promoting podcast parties, not just book groups, podcast groups. Listen to a podcast, and then each one of you share what you got out of it. Now, imagining as a group listening to this podcast, having read the book, and then inviting Ona on to a Zoom where she can then talk about it to you.
Oh, I love that idea.
So that
Thank
idea is
you.
put out there, folks. Reach Ona to discuss it. You can reach her through her site or through Instagram. Read the book, have a book club, have a podcast book. The book is reading the book. The podcast, as you can hear, is revealing different things. But have a conversation. Let's take this conversation further. It's not just about her sister's life and her life. It's about the lives of so many that have been left behind, right? Just like my Forgotten Children book, it is about children that have been forgotten, that are not given the love and the nurturing they need. Let this be a story that keeps on telling so we can prevent it from happening, so we can be aware of what to look for. So we don't see such tragedies happen to families and loved ones. Thank you so much for sharing with us today, Ona, and thank you for
Thank you,
honoring your
Sarah.
sister by writing this book.
Thank you. I
And
really,
thank
really love talking to you about
you.
it.
What's Pooch's name?
This is Portia.
Portia, thank you for supporting your mummy all the way through this. For people who are just listening, Portia's been on her lap all the way through. Yes, Portia, giving mummy support. And let not forget, our animals are there to support us through it all. Big kisses. So thank you, Portia. And to everyone out there, know that to lose one is one too many. Right? And we need to make sure that no child is lost, no child is forgotten, and that all families are supported. That if the parents are going through a hard time, they need support, they need counseling so they can be better parents. This isn't just throw people away because, right? This is step up and be a part of the solution by caring. So until next time, folks, bye for now. We hope that you enjoyed the show. There are so many more for you here on selfdiscoverywisdom.com. Just go to the podcast tag at the top there and you will see all the many genres and all 3,000 shows ready for your listening. We are here to serve you, to help you on your journey of life. And we know that through inspiration, it begets invitation. We are supported by you, the listeners, and those that we interview. Anything that you can spare us in donation would be greatly accepted. And we do hope that you enjoy the next show.